Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Andre Lewis. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felst, and Ian Guzder. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 7:59, and coming up next, Abe and Joe talk to Ryan Curran with Portland's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability about some of the city's equitable housing strategies.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
Well, we got a crowded schedule this morning. Okay, this is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial here in Portland, Oregon. We are going to deal with a bit of more interesting stuff this year and this time, and I'm going to, in the second half of this show, talk a little bit about madness and the presidency. I can't not do that. But to call, 231-8187. With us now by phone is Ryan Curran. Is that right?
That's right. And before we go to Ryan, I want to provide a little context. Oh, I'm Abe, by the way.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And we're going to talk about something, and a recurring theme on this show, and that is development, sustainable development in the city of Portland. More specifically, how do we combat the trend of gentrification that is taking over so many parts of our town and displacing so many populations, many of whom have lived in their neighborhoods for generations? We've seen this happen all over the city. We're also going to talk about the extension of the light rail line down the Southwest Corridor to Tigard and Tualatin. This is something, again, that we've touched upon on this show many times in the past. If you recall, many years ago, we had then-Mayor Sam Adams on this show to talk about the proposed expansion of the streetcar to the east side of Portland. And when Mayor Adams was on, we asked a couple of what I think are very pertinent and rather basic questions surrounding the notion of expanding light rail. We asked the mayor at that time why the plan was to run the streetcar in a loop in inner southeast Portland rather than, say, run it up Hawthorne or run it up Powell or put it someplace to serve the existing population. And Mayor Adams' response was, we want the streetcar to drive development. We don't want the streetcar to service already developed regions. And we've seen what this has led to. The Pearl District is anything but an affordable part of town. It is in fact Portland's boutique neighborhood that grew up around the expansion of the streetcar. So there's this basic disconnect that we have perceived on the show, and I'm sure many of you have out there as well, that we wonder exactly whom is the rail expansion serving? The people who already live in Portland or the developers who stand to make a lot of money developing, or as in this case, redeveloping Barber Boulevard to the southwest? So with these questions in mind, we want to welcome to the show Ryan Curran, of Portland's Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, who is going to talk about the city's plan to make sure that families are not displaced along the new rail line. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You bet. I hope I didn't pile too much on your plate right there.
No, not at all.
So, first of all, I'm willing to put a little faith in good governance here. I'm glad that the city has a plan to develop the Southwest Corridor in an equitable and sustainable way. My question to you is, should we take that at face value, or should we approach that skeptically?
That's a good question. You know, the question of how will it be different this time? You know, we We don't know if it will be. We certainly want to believe that we've learned from the past mistakes and harm, especially to communities of color, and we know what will happen if we aren't successful. I think the yellow line along North Interstate is a good example of good policies, good intentions, but poor follow through. You know, we knew an area with a history of discriminatory public policy and disinvestment would eventually become desirable with new light rail and increase the housing costs of the predominantly African-American families who live there. And, you know, in response, we adopted great anti-displacement policies and even affordable housing targets that were pretty aggressive. But eventually, the funding from the urban renewal area was slow to materialize, and in the meantime, was reprioritized while thousands of households, predominantly African-American households, were priced out, and a lot of our housing goals were unmet. So we definitely know we need to do it better, and we need to do it right this time. You know, we're not alone in this. No city in the U.S. has figured it out, and most big cities are in the same type of housing crisis that we are also in. But we do have some recent examples of cities that have made that upfront investment and are really trying to get it right. Just last fall, Seattle, Los Angeles, Oakland, they all voted to approve ballot measures that allocated, you know, billions of dollars in both transit and housing. So they paired those together, and we're seeing this as a successful formula more and more. Mm. So this time, you know, as we develop the Southwest Corridor's equitable housing strategy, we hope, you know, to have more dedicated funding sources that are available earlier, before the light rail comes online and increases that desirability and exacerbates the housing crisis that we already are seeing along the corridor. We hope that we have stronger agreements, kind of accountability agreements in place with our partners. And frankly, we need more partners in this work. We can't, the cities of Portland and the cities of Tigard can't do this alone. So, you know, that's why it's important that folks show up this Saturday. Let your voice be heard. We're having a community learning and listening session down at Markham Elementary School, and I hope to tell you some more about that event.
Can you tell us a little bit about the planned Southwest Corridor extension a little more broadly? Where is this line going to run exactly?
So my work is focused on the housing strategy alongside mm-hmm. the transit corridor. Mm-hmm. For years now, the region has been planning for new transit in Southwest. And last year, the decision was made for light rail to serve downtown Portland, along Barber, to Tigard, downtown Tigard, and then in Tualatin, Bridgeport Village is the terminus.
Okay.
There's an environmental impact phase going on right now. A steering committee staffed by Metro and TriMet is overseeing that process. And next spring, you and your listeners will probably see more media attention given to the decision by all the different jurisdictions about what we call the locally preferred alternative, about where the stations are, where the alignment is exactly. And so that's why the cities of Portland and the cities of Tigard, we're doing this housing strategy in addition to that, so that when we approve the light rail, we are also approving a housing strategy that's hopefully meaningful and hopefully does a better job this time.
I find that very interesting, and having seen the almost success of light rail in Portland, I have some questions I can't help but ask. One question, of course, the obvious one is, where's the money?
Now, are you specifically referring to the transit project or for the housing?
Either one. Where's the money?
So my understanding is for the housing strategy is that there currently is not any identified funding source.
So there's no money at this point for the housing.
In the city of Portland, we're very dependent upon the urban renewal areas to provide funding for affordable housing in those targeted areas. We just passed a citywide housing bond, so that's a new tool that we have not yet spent yet, and are hoping to do so with lots of oversight and intent. The city of Tigard also last fall passed an urban renewal area by their voters. So it is yet to be determined where the housing funding is, but transit funding is going to become predominantly from local sources and hopefully from the federal government if they still support transit.
Well, okay, putting aside the fact that we now live in fascist Trump land, I'm really dubious. I have to say this. I am a person who has studied urban in the School of Urban Studies. I'm a person who's worked on various projects in neighborhoods. But I'm seeing, and I understand your enthusiasm, and I understand that you're rightly hopeful about this, because in the long run, light rail transit is a logical thing, and creating housing for poorer people is a logical thing. But there are a number of real, real serious questions that have come up over the years. One of which is, if you build housing, I guess there are a series of questions. If you build housing, will it be quality housing, and how can that be paid for? Secondly, how does one ensure, because the reality of American habit is not going to change overnight, that every one of those units has at least one parking place off street? And is that part of the plan, or is that something which will be glossed over with the assumption that people will just have to learn to take the choo-choo?
So our focus has currently been on the housing needs of low-income residents in the corridor, and then kind of and trying to anticipate the future needs given kind of the diversifying population and the growth that we're seeing, the folks that are moving here and are looking for housing and not finding affordable options and choices. So the focus has really been on who's in need and what type of housing will meet their needs. And assuming that the light rail service is a good thing that improves folks' lives, we want those who are there now to benefit from that, that they're not displaced by those increased housing costs and get to actually benefit from that better transit service. So we're mostly just focused on the type of housing and the affordability of housing.
I don't think I'm questioning the sincerity of the system, nor am I questioning the desirability of what you say is to be done. What I'm really asking, and I can't help but ask it because we're so close to the beginning of projects, I don't understand and I don't see a number of things. Barbara Boulevard, which I'm very familiar with, Barbara Boulevard is a major transit street still with automobiles, and indeed it would make sense to take a bunch of those cars off the road and provide a rapid transit system to serve the populations all the way out to Tigard and beyond. The problems I'm having are the problems I hear from all sorts of people from the inner city. Those who work, and more of them do, out in the valley, find that the transit system is woefully slow and woefully crowded and woefully really unreliable for people needing to do what they do when they need to do it. Now, that is all solvable. That is all construction-wise solvable. Yet, here we are, I don't see anything here that reassures me. I don't see maybe it'll happen before anything's built, but I don't see any physical descriptions. I don't see any discussion of who will be displaced to build it. I don't see any discussion of what will happen to automobile traffic and how people will be fundamentally persuaded to change the habits of over 50 years. So I'm really asking, how is this to be accomplished, particularly given that we have a incredibly stupid federal government at this time that shows no interest in mass transit at all, or for that matter, distant transit by land?
Those are all good questions. We hear those a lot.
I'll bet you do.
We're working with a broad base of community partners that are doing direct engagement with low-income tenants, so Community Alliance of Tenants and OPAL and Unite Oregon, Muslim Educational Trust. They're all working with their constituents in the corridor and understanding not just their housing needs, but when you ask someone, you know, what their needs are today, they give you a list beyond just housing. And so how are, for example, shift workers going to access the transit on off-peak hours is a thing we hear often. What are the rights and education of residents to withstand a increase in rent, or if they want to access homeownership opportunities, what are the resources that they can receive? And those are all the kind of questions that are piling up, and we hope to address through this housing strategy, and partially, but hopefully with our partners.
Ryan, do you have time to take a phone call or two from our listeners?
I do.
All right. Who do we have? Chris, good morning. What's on your mind? Hello. All right, we'll come back to Chris if we can. So let me ask you this then, Ryan. You know, as Joe, I think, detailed in pretty thoroughly, there's a lot of reasons for Portlanders to be skeptical of the fact that this will, in fact, in the end, be an equitable development of the Southwest Transit Corridor. And these, the roots of the skepticism go way, way back. I mean, the the construction of Legacy Emanuel Hospital, for example, still rankles many people who used to live in that part of town. And likewise, the construction of Interstate 5. It just seems over the decades, with project after project, that despite what may be good intentions, and despite language and statements emphasizing those good intentions, in the end, it seems to be first the developers of these areas that win, and it's the longtime residents that seem to end up losing. So what is fundamentally different this time around?
This is the question. We, at the end of the day, ultimately have to approve a locally preferred alternative for the transit project, and alongside it, a housing strategy that's meaningful. And so the measure of that meaningfulness is going to be determined differently by different people. I think one measure is a question you asked earlier about, is it funded? Is it capitalized? Another one is around accountability, is what's the monitoring and who's doing the work? I guess that's another question you asked, is who benefits? Mm-hmm. So there are currently not much affordable housing in Southwest. Home Forward has some. The Community Partners for Affordable Housing is a small nonprofit with a few apartment buildings. But the question of who is going to do this work and really meet this housing need is there's not a clear answer there. So some new actors will need to enter into the Southwest corridor to do this work over the long haul. And what's the city and Metro and TriMet, what's their relationship with those actors? Like, how are we supporting their missions? How are we funding their projects? And then ultimately, how are they then accountable to low-income and communities of color and actually meeting their needs? And those are all the kind of accountability agreements that we hope to put in place so that it's really clear to outside observers and folks in Southwest that those goals and those aspirations that we put forth in the strategy are being followed through. Okay. One way to really be clear about that is land. I think secured land that is dedicated for affordable and mixed income housing and community uses, those sites are very tangible and people can see them and they can track their development over time. It's not just funding that could disappear or targets that could be downsized. It's like these are clear sites along the corridor that we hope actually meet our goals.
And hopefully they'll be in proximity to transit stops, ideally.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The Barber Transit Center is a good example, or Portland Community College is interested in affordable housing. There will be plenty of sites that are available after the construction of the light rail. TriMet usually buys property that they use for construction staging and then they dispose of. And so getting some affordability requirements on those sites is an important indicator of our commitment.
I think we've got a caller standing by. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
Michael, make it short, please.
Yes, I got two things I want to ask about. First of all, the self-driving cars are coming. And once you have a fleet of self-driving things like Uber, who's going to take light rail? I mean, right now, I just read last week that ridership and transit is decreasing over, last year and possibly the year before. So that's one question. I think light rail is an obsolete 19th century technology, and I don't understand why in the 21st century you want to spend money on something like that. That's first of all. Second of all, if the planners decide to do to Barber Boulevard the same thing they did to Interstate and cut the traffic lanes for cars from two lanes in each direction to one lane, in each direction, there's going to be a revolution in Tigard, and Tigard's going to pull out of that plan. So if you decide to go ahead with it, which I think is a bad idea, you would better leave those traffic lanes alone. Otherwise, the whole thing is going to die, I think.
All right. Well, hey, thank you for the call, Michael. Ryan, do you have any comment on that? I realize your area of expertise is housing, but perhaps you might have something to say.
Yeah, absolutely. My expertise is on housing, and we're really focused on increasing housing choice and the preventing displacement are the two main goals that we're looking at. The transit project is going through an environmental impact phase that's looking at issues of traffic and service, and that process is playing out, you know, over the next 6 to 8 months. So I'm hoping that folks get a lot of answers out of that. But if they want to learn more and also provide some input into the transportation project, our event on Saturday, I want to make a plug for it.
Sure.
TriMet and Metro, they will be there, and so there is an opportunity to provide input on the transit project. The focus is going to be on housing and kind of what are the needs of renters and homeowners in the corridor. We've done a lot of outreach to renters and low-income residents, communities of color, especially immigrant communities. Our partners in the community are doing that outreach directly. So we're hoping for a real high-energy, you know, inclusive, welcoming event. We'll have the Community Alliance of Tenants and the Community Housing Fund will be there to share their expertise on affordable housing and what they're hearing directly from tenants in this process. Mayor of Portland, Ted Wheeler, and councilors from Metro and Tigard will be there to kind of make remarks about what local government's role is in ensuring that this, you know, this once-in-a-lifetime investment really benefits all people. It's very family-friendly. There'll be food from Muslim Educational Trust is doing catering. We have child care. We have entertainment from Danza Azteca is going to be there to perform, and there'll be interpreters on site in Somali, Arabic, and Spanish. So we're really hoping to have a great turnout and a real high-energy event, and folks can come down and let their voice be heard.
I really appreciate, and I think it's an authentic desire to have citizen input in this process. But what you're really describing is not empowerment, but airing of grievance, airing of hopes. It's essentially, in my experience, and I've been to a lot of things run by what used to be called, more honestly, PDC, and by TriMet, and invariably, a whole set of strategies are inadvertently, to be polite, used, which disempower people. It's not a mass meeting. It's not a process where people would come in by a number, you know, grab a number and then be called in that number. Usually it breaks into small groups. Small groups are usually managed by somebody in that group. The process is a compromise away from democracy and towards a sense of participation, which is not always authentic. And I really am asking, how will you be structuring this so that every voice is encouraged to be heard? And how are you going to do it in an afternoon?
So to be absolutely clear, this event is your more traditional Saturday morning publicly convened workshop and open house, you know, session. So your critique is probably spot on. The one indicator of that this will be different this time is that probably half of our project budget is in community grants to community-based organizations directly working with and serving low-income residents. So they're running a whole other parallel community engagement effort and what they term as community-based research to develop, you know, recommendations that we are committed to incorporating some of which. So, you know, when the Community Alliance of Tenants is in the lead on this work with OPAL Environmental Justice of Oregon and Community Partners for Affordable Housing and others, they're out there engaging directly with tenants in specific buildings along the corridor that are seeing these rent increases, that are having these issues in housing. And they're doing this kind of qualitative research to develop recommendations that our advisory group is committed to adopting some of, right? Well, so we're making that space, and they're going to be there. That group of partners, they're going to be there long after this project is completed. Like they're and so are we. But it's not in the same form, because this project is only a 1-year project. But We're hoping for real lasting capacity in the corridor. Like I said, there's not a lot of nonprofits and community-based organizations in the corridor, but we hope after this project that some are empowered and have the capacity to stay over the long term. And that will help us with accountability as well.
Okay, I appreciate the sincerity involved, but here's my demographic analysis. And I have to say, I'm going to toot my own horn. I've produced a master's and a PhD in areas relating to urban studies and issues of power. I look at what you're planning to do, and I don't see anything, aside from some better language, that's really different. I see a pattern which, once again, will put people on the defensive, which will not embrace, for example, the community of older people who have frequently in the Tigard area, in that region, expressed fear of opening up the area to people who are poor and dispossessed and angry, and from that community's point of view, dangerous. That's a real fear. Whether or not it's a real problem, I don't know. I do feel very strongly that I don't hear anything here that tells me in very specific terms how it is going to be different. I understand your sincerity. I understand even the city's sincerity and perhaps TriMet's sincerity. But I don't follow here anything that makes me happy about what is about to happen when I am, and I want to be clear about this, a very strong advocate for public transit. For example, just on the very most basic levels, TriMet still hasn't figured out how to deliver its service speedily and reasonably and cheaply. It's not happening, and it is a system still that creates an enormous amount of I will call it dystopian feeling wherever it goes. You guys really must understand that there's an enormous well of disappointment and anger and a sense of failure of the system in all of this, and yet you're proceeding with yet another project that to me has the odor of similar projects in the past. You got to convince me somehow that this one is going to be different, not because there are stakeholders involved, not because the intention is or isn't good. Ultimately, I look at it economically. This is going to benefit developers. This is going to thicken up the city's population with a theoretical notion that somehow this will protect urban, non-urban lands. None of that has proven to be true. Where are you going? How are you going to do it? What is going to be really, truly different? I'm not, aside from descriptions of more people involved who are experts or community leaders or whatever, I don't see any difference. Please, make me feel better.
Well, I certainly can't just say, trust me, that's not going to work.
No.
But I do encourage you in the springtime to bring us back and have us really look at and dissect what are the proposals within the housing strategy.
What's
the proposal
for funding? That's fair.
What's the proposal for sites? How much of the goal is actually meeting the need? I think that'll be a good indicator of how meaningful this work is. So in springtime is when you can really look at the clear proposals that are within the strategy and determine whether that these are meaningful and they're going to be followed through. Between then and now, I do encourage you to reach out to some of our community partners and understand not just their work engaging tenants directly and what they're hearing, because that's an important story, but also what kind of recommendations are coming out of that and what do they think the city and other institutional partners should be doing to follow through on the community's recommendations. I think that's an important line of questioning that could probably help you understand how or if this will be different at all.
Well, I think
if you have any ideas, please share.
You know, I think we may take you up on having you back in the springtime and keep tabs on this
That'd
project. How about we'll take one more call and we'll let you go.
Thanks.
Sounds good. Okay. Chris, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. Last time that didn't work. I'm kind of with you guys on this. Ryan, thank you so much for braving this interview. I'm sure that this isn't your first turn at feeling the skepticism behind this project. You yourself mentioned that this, you know, the trend of gentrification is a national trend, and you said that there's not a city that has figured this out yet. And so really what I'm seeing is that the developers are the ones who get to pull the strings and who get to determine what happens. You brought up the interstate corridor. I actually just pulled into work right off of the interstate corridor, and I can tell you that people are getting displaced from around here in the Arbor Lodge neighborhood left and right. And it's because of the light rail, right? And the expansion of light rail into East County only accelerated gentrification out of North and Northeast Portland. And so I fear that the same thing is going to happen by pushing out into the outer reaches of Southwest Portland, in the same way that the West Side MAX that goes out to Hillsboro affects and facilitates gentrification. And you can probably confirm this, that what we're seeing is now this repopulation of urban centers that have been systematically neglected thanks to white flight, which was what created the suburbs. And now we're seeing the inversion of that same process, where reinvestment is now happening in the city center and poverty is being pushed out into a ring. And MAX and TriMet are facilitating those processes. And so I'm super concerned that without any changes to affordable housing law, right? Oregon is still one of only two states in the country that has a ban on requiring developers to implement affordable housing. And I hear you say that, well, what we're going to do is we're going to get these quote-unquote accountability agreements. But as I recall, didn't we have some sort of accountability agreement around the development of South Waterfront and affordable housing there? And I believe what happened was the city ended up paying over again to put less affordable housing than the initial waterfront development plan was supposed to have in it. So, Ryan, I'm super skeptical. I mean, before this process has even gotten started. And then your description of this listening session sounds like exactly what Joe just described, where what we're going to get is people get to come, say what they think. They're going to feel like they were heard, while the system is going to keep continuing to roll on, and developers are going to make the final decisions about which of the sum recommendations are going to be accepted and which of the sum are going to hurt their bottom line and therefore are going to be rejected. So I'm super skeptical. I haven't heard a single thing that you've said that has given any assurance to this being any different from any other project that has done nothing but accelerate gentrification.
Okay, I'm gonna cut you off because yeah. I want to give Ryan a chance to respond, and then we're gonna change topics. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Ryan. I know this isn't about you, but you're representing a system that is insidious, and I feel like, you know, we need to make much deeper changes than just trying to do this differently. It's not about intention. It's about impact and outcome. Thank you very much.
All right, Ryan, you want to respond? I mean, I don't want you to disappear without a response to that.
I appreciated the really thorough overview of the demographic and economic forces at play that we are pushing up against to try to get this right at this time. I mean, again, I'll go back to my original comment that we know what happens if we don't try something new. And then to try something new is going to require not just a bold vision and new types of leadership, but the risk that comes with that, the risk to fail. So I hope that starts with, you know, a commitment to new resources that are available early and really meet the needs of those who are there now, as well as anticipating who's moving in. I will say that the... Please come to our event on Saturday and see if it really is.
Well,
as you say, I think it'll be a different energy. It'll be a very diverse crowd. We've done a really good job on outreach, and I'm hoping that it not only feels different, but actually results in something different too.
Okay, Ryan,
9:30 to 12:30 at Markham Elementary.
Okay, I appreciate your sincerity. That's number one. Number two, the language you use is nice. The possibility that this meeting will be much better managed is certainly there. My problems are at root. Where's the money? Show me the money. I don't see a chunk of change that's going to make all of the good things you want to do possible. And I look at the larger picture in the United States, where Oregon becomes an outlier because it has a center liberal kind of government. I only see a growing disproportionate gain for the rich and a disproportionate loss for the poor coming down the road in the midst of a world, and I'm going to be changing topics very shortly, that looks to me very much like a place that goes into a, that stumbles like World War I into a war. Anyway, that's not your bailiwick. I do want to thank you for coming here, and I do want to keep in touch with you guys, and I am very much interested in the process. And while I'm admittedly disappointed in general in what's happened in the past, I am still hopeful that you can pull it off. And I wish you a lot of luck. And yeah, maybe I'll be there Saturday. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Okay, we're gonna change topics completely here because I can't stand it anymore. I really can't stand it anymore. I feel like the Rush Limbaugh of the left or something. You know. No, because he's a clown and he's a faker. I'm not, I don't think. I might be a clown. I'm not a faker. I really do believe that Bob Corker, of all people, a conservative Republican, has labeled accurately what should have been labeled accurately by all serious Republicans, that by some tricks of the Russians and of fate and of missteps, we now have a president of the United States who is obviously unsuited to the office. He might be well suited to some reality TV show, which is all he knows how to do, as far as I can tell, in the public sphere, coming out of a family of racists and gambling advocates and so on. Looking at this guy, looking at Donald Trump, looking at his history in every aspect of his life, I see a selfish, thoughtless, grotesque character who is now president of the United States and whips up an issue whenever he's challenged, rightfully, on anything he wants to do. I see him actually engaging in a word fight with the guy I used to call Little King. Now I'm loath to insult him. That essentially is a guy who's going to have and has nuclear weapons and seems very authentically ready and eager to use them, despite the fact that it would destroy his nation. And I see this happening in the context of a peninsula where the southern part is extremely economically important and serves the world, including the United States, and has a lot of people. And I see this in the context of a nation that doesn't have any public information of a real sort at all. And I'm watching this clown treat that clown as if it's all something he can either bluff his way through or destroy physically. And I'm terrified. I see World War III looming in the mirror, coming up fast. And I don't think the American people are adequately angry or terrified or active. I love seeing the demos. I love seeing the fights. But those are the street. They're not the method that will change the way things are going. And I wonder, I really wonder how we can deal with this. I don't think the Republicans will allow the president to be fired, even if it's proven, which I think it will be, that the Russians meddled in the election so significantly that it's an invalid election. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think a lot of things are going to happen. We don't have a constitution that is ready for this modern, horrible situation. And I don't see the outrage in the general world that should be there. I mean, this guy is an idiot. I mean, let me repeat that word, because I don't like to use a term that's old-fashioned unless I'm really clear about it. This guy, Donald Trump, is an idiot. He's a sexist. He's a racist. He's a fool. He's all about himself. And he's incredibly dangerous, and he has his finger on the nuclear button. What do we do about this? Because any solution now depends upon two failing political parties, the weak-ass Democrats and the untrustworthy and weird Republicans. So I throw it out to you. We got a few minutes left. Give me a call. Tell me what to do. Help! Wow. Change the topic kind of threw everybody there, huh? No, I'm I have been involved in peace movement stuff. I'm an old guy. I've been involved since 1960 when I helped organize the first peace march against the bomb. 1960. I have been involved in various struggles. I was involved in the 1970 uprisings when the National Guard shot in Ohio, shot these people, and in the South when they shot up a dormitory for black students. I have been involved in various efforts. I have been proudly a resister of the draft. I was very glad that I could call the Vietnam War the way it was, the way it is, and the way it has been. I am very much, very much dismayed at the fact that we failed. You know, we stopped this, we stopped that, but the fact of the matter is the greater bulk of American foreign policy at this point is to present itself as a dramatically dominant force in the world, disinterested in the viability of the planet, disinterested in the welfare of ordinary people, and in meddling in other countries' affairs, just as it has since, let's say, 1954, was it? When we overthrew, and this is important, the legitimate government of Iran and installed instead a clown prince who put in a terrorizing organization, a secret organization, the Savak. And when it was overthrown by a really reactionary, what evolved into a reactionary religious party, we now are arguing insanely about our ability to dominate when we don't really have it. Hey, I'm asking a question. What do you think? What should we do? I'm going to go to the phones. John, you're on the air.
Hello. I don't mean to depress you more. I was at the dentist office. You know, at the dentist office, they have all kinds of, you know, magazines.
Ah, yes.
October 2nd, Time Magazine.
Yeah.
The failure, I mean, the what do you call it, disappearing of the Democratic Party. And I didn't read the whole article because, you know, it's like 5 pages long, and my dentist, you know, finally came around. But they had a...
So you were rescued by pain. Anyway, never mind. Go ahead.
Well, I know I was looking at the maps of political maps, red state, blue state. I hate using that terminology, but that's what we're stuck with the mass media and whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, the election of, like John Kerry, and then it went on to Barack Obama, and then had the main map, what's going on now, and it's even worse because it was divided with, you know, between, like, just the deep south. And then you have little spots of red, you know, like in Nebraska and North Dakota. Well, this one showed everything solid red with just little dabs of blue on the West Coast and then up the Mid-Atlantic states, a couple of them in the dabs of blue in Illinois and Florida, and everything deep red. So I'm looking at that I'm sorry, but most of the public is supporting, you know, according to this map, are supporting Trump and the Republicans. And the Democrats, you know, they don't have squat. I mean, people are just more like, I don't know what, I know Time Magazine is very conservative and everything, but, I mean, they had everything from Idaho to Indiana just solid red from North Dakota to Arkansas down to Louisiana and clear up to the Carolinas. I mean, just, and then they had, like, you know, their, what do you call it, facts to support it. And so they were just talking about, you know, Democrats are completely, you know, like, I don't know, unarmed. They don't even have a strategy to come through this. And they were just asking, where are the Democrats? I mean, they did mention a couple of people there who are up and coming. But I'm just getting to the point that the people, I mean, a lot of people really support this guy. And when I heard that 41.8% of women voted for Trump, I mean, that even got sunk even lower. I mean, that's like over a third?
Yeah, so quite a bit over a third.
I'm just looking at the statistics. I know Time Magazine, you know, was whatever. But also I'm just saying that the way that they put the political demographics on it, I mean, two-thirds of the country is still solid Republican and supporting.
Well,
you know.
Okay, let me first of all address that issue. That's not That's not an actual measure of anything. The election was very, very close. In fact, I think if you take away the Russian impact, probably, certainly Hillary won the popular vote, but probably taking away that impact, she would have won the general election. Yes, we have a problem with the way in which our electoral process is structured by the founding fathers who wanted to keep democracy under control. Yes, there are issues here that are very, very real, and it's happened more than once that the popular candidate has lost. But I don't think we have a mass movement to the right as a national phenomenon. What we do have is a population that has been poorly schooled and desperate and angry in many, many places because the reality of the way the world economy is changing, most of the good paying jobs that are working class and lower middle class that are physical are being disappeared. The machines do it better. It's just impossible to combat that looking at countries where labor costs are lower, China and so on, and where in fact machines are becoming leaders in the production of things. All that is real. On the other hand, we are a nation that has a very, very strong tradition of what I will just abstractly call democracy or fair play. And that still exists. It is not going to go away. Arming it, persuading it to take action is a challenge. The media pretends to be neutral, but in fact, as it grows more and more dismayed, we're going to see some very, very big changes about things. I predict that Trump will maybe survive even into the second election, despite the fact that he might get indicted for his crimes, and despite the fact that his whole family might get indicted, and despite the fact that there's absolute evidence of collusion with the Russians in the election. All of that will not change that, but it will have an impact on the consciousness of the people as we see real services, healthcare services, land use services, the creation of an environment that's healthy, and so on and so forth. People are not completely stupid. They'll wake up. They'll become more and more angry and more aroused. That's all I think about that.
Just one more before I hang up.
Sure.
I hear that one on the what's on the table with the Supreme Court coming up, the federal Supreme Court,
gotcha,
is the gerrymandering, you know, situation.
Right.
And I mean, I'm crossing my fingers. It might be 5-4 against it. I don't know. But I just figure if, I hope, you know, the Supreme Court, you know, like, goes in favor of just, you know, voting it down, I think that might have a more fair play of what's going on, you know, with all this, I don't know, redistricting and everything, you know, whatever. But that is something I see positive happening, even though this Supreme Court is sort of, well, let's say, there's like 4 out of the 9 I really like, but, you know, that's another issue. But anyways, that's what my whole thing, I was just shocked, just the way that the political landscape was going, and I don't understand, you know, how, you know, like, poor people in Missouri and, you know, in Alabama could still continue to vote against their interests. That's all I'm trying to say. Well, thanks for your call.
Yeah, no, I appreciate. I appreciate your concern, and I share it. But I actually will continue to think that people are not inherently stupid. They may be ignorant because the system encourages their ignorance. I mean, we've lived in a mythological world of American exceptionalism for a long, long time, and that is a hard nut to crack. However, that the fact that we may be slipping steadily into World War III has got to waken people up. Never mind the fact that we are I think the term woke is very good. Never mind the fact that we are extremely racist, that we are extremely sexist, that we extremely disfavor the poorer part of our population, which is the majority of us. But there comes a time when you must fundamentally begin to recognize the possibility for social change. And I believe that exists. There is a kernel of real thoughtful concern among every class of citizen, every class of educated person in America. And in a way, we're lucky that we got the clown fascist as president because he makes everything so clear. But let's see. Let's talk to some other folks. Francis, you're on the air.
Yes, that man has lifted up the rug, and it's all there for us to see. Just like how we're going to handle it, just a question. People are coming out of the woodwork with their racist, hateful things. Mm-hmm. And that's what's alarming to me, because they're actually hurting other people.
Yes.
And I think the man should be arrested right now for perpetrating all this stuff, but, you know, that's me.
By the man, you mean the president?
Yes, that POTUS guy.
Okay.
But, you know, also the Congress, they're responsible. If they knew who he was, all those Republicans who pretend like they didn't know how awful he really was, and they're allowing this to continue. And to me, they are complicit. And at some point, they need to realize. I think this one guy, Corker, is kind of trying to make them aware of that. At a point, it comes to a point where they will be held accountable for what this man is doing. And they are already. I'm not sure. You know, there's an oath that everyone's required to take an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Oh, you mean officers of the government?
Yeah, and policemen and everybody. But the president takes an oath in front of everybody, in the whole world, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. What does that mean? Why did they even make him take an oath? Because he's violating the oath and the Constitution left and right all day long. And is there any... If somebody violates that oath, what's the consequence? Nothing? I really am asking a question. Is there a consequence? Why do we make them take an oath?
Well, the only way we're going to be able to answer that question is to see what happens in the next few weeks or months or even years. But you raise a good point. There really isn't a process. For example, there's no process to do over an election. If it turns out, as I believe it will, that this election was incredibly distorted and corrupted by outside powers, by a foreign nation, among other things, by the irresponsibility of all the mass online computer services and so on. If that turns out to be true, which I believe it will, there still is no response that you can do except to impeach the president, which doesn't deal with the structure that has been created or the laws that have been passed or the compromises that have been made. You are right to be concerned. I don't know an answer, except I know that there is, within the power of the American people, an ability to really take a big step toward
right.
change.
Right, and as I was looking at how many people actually voted, the man, it was a very small percentage of people in this country elected that man.
That's true.
And so there's a lot of people who don't vote for whatever reason. Either they don't choose to, or they can't because of some of these laws.
Well, remember that
laws.
Yeah, but Francis, just really quickly, remember that there has been an unending effort to disqualify people and discourage people.
That's what I was
gonna say. So to say there isn't enough people voting, yeah, and probably it should be more.
But I was trying to reassure this man earlier that really the majority of the people in this country are loving, caring people.
Well, that I don't know. I don't know how you measure that.
They're not haters. They're not haters. They're doing their own thing. But I think that I still want to know, why is it such a big deal to require someone to take an oath if they don't have to honor it?
Well, you're asking an important question, but it's not answerable.
Why do we do that if there's no penalty for violating that oath?
Well, theoretically, there is the ultimate penalty of getting rid of the fascist in chief. But yes, you're right. We have a lot of structural errors in our system. It was a system designed in the 18th century. It was designed to preserve the power of white land-owning, slave-owning people.
Well, our local police department calls it constitutional gobbledygook, so I don't know, maybe nobody cares in that regard. Anybody that's required to take the oath just considers it gobbledygook.
Who said that it was gobbledygook?
Years ago, the Portland Police Department, you know, the little rap sheet newsletter?
Sure. Well, it's actually a newspaper, but yeah.
When people were opposing the drug-free zones, in their little paper, they referred to it as constitutional gobbledygook.
Ah, okay.
Anyway, I just That's an aside. But I had another thought, and I don't remember what it is. But you guys have a good day. And
all right. I appreciate the call, Francis.
Take care.
All right. 231-8187. We have moved away from the question of transit development and housing development in Portland to the larger national and international question of what is to be done, given that we have this crazy fascist egomaniac as president who seems to want, as in his ideas, to have some kind of reality TV show where he fights the little king, and he himself is crazy, and they're going to fight us into a war if we're not careful. What is to be done? I'd love to hear from you. Barth, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen, and the larger KBOO audience. It seems like the wave is starting to break a little bit. We're having a lot of important defections within the party. He's not getting the vote majority for everything that he wants.
That's true.
And now, you know, he says, oh, well, I'll give you this tidbit if you give me everything I want. And even the Republicans are seeing that as ridiculous. I don't think that he's going to get the mandates that he expected, and I believe that, as Francis said, the country is morally rather separate from the Trump administration's agenda, and that that outrage and that disbelief should push people into a more active state. The big question is, you know, we're going to get a term out of him anyway, I'm pretty sure. I don't think that impeachment is really going to go anywhere. But what is our alternative come another election?
That's really a good question. And is, you know, we only have two parties that really are functional in our national system, unfortunately. And both parties are extremely compromised. The Democrats are no longer the FDR Democrats. The Republicans are no longer responsible conservatives. They're on a wacky course. And there's an overarching set of problems, racism, sexism, ageism, classism. All these things have not gone away and have probably gotten, in many ways, more exacerbated. So you're asking, and I'm asking, well, what's going to happen? What's to be done? And the answer really rests with the American people and the question of whether or not they can be woke.
Oh, agreed. And the other question one of your callers posed is, you know, what the Supreme Court is going to do about gerrymandering. And the question there, the primary question there, is are they going to fall back onto ideology, or are they going to respect the law? And in the past, we had some confidence that the Supreme Court would, you know, when push came to shove, would default on the side of actual law. And now, with the wave that's been going on for the last 10 years or so, primarily, the Supreme Court seems to be tumbling directly into political partisanship.
Well, you know, I'm running out of time. I agree with what you're saying, and I also have to add, I can't answer any of that. We have to, all of us, activate ourselves. We have to not just show up for demos, which is a good idea, by the way, and have big crowds in the streets, always important, but we need to do more work than that. We need to be in more conscious awareness and fighting and struggling and writing and doing everything we can to make things better. And the fact that we are dissuaded from that is not an accident. It's a systemic phenomenon, disenfranchising voters, all kinds of nonsense. But we can, because other countries have done it as well, we can build democracy for real in the United States. I hearken to my theme music. And I really appreciate your call, man. And I
really
hope...
Really quickly?
Yeah, go ahead, real quick.
Let's fight corporate politics, make corporations non-persons, and make voting relevant.
I agree with you.
Agreed, and... dissuaded from the future and entering the past.
Okay, man. Thanks very much for the call. You know, I'm looking at the clock and I'm out of time and I can't take any more calls. We did two different things today. We began with a conversation about the proposed light rail, which is almost certain to be built out toward Tigard and beyond. And we talked about how that's trying to be linked up by the builders thereof to better housing for poorer people, both of which are possible, both of which are doable, neither of which has adequate funding. So, you know, that's a problem. We turn our attention to the international phenomenon of the crazy people running North Korea and the United States. And I find little hope there. I am absolutely appalled, and I want to be clear about this, that we have elected a fascist egomaniac as president of the United States, and he's only now being challenged by some people of a similar, theoretically similar ideology, conservatives. Y'all stay tuned. Remember, KBOO, the best in music and public affairs. And we'll see you next week.
Yeah. From those gnats in Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMenamin's Mission Theater in Portland. Radiance of Resistance is an award-winning documentary that tells the story of two youths who have become global ambassadors for Palestinian human rights. The film is an intimate look at their everyday lives and roles as part of a new generation of Palestinian civil rights leaders. Again, that's Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMenamin's Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland and at 10 o'clock, Aircast.